that, so it just includes that first group. You know, I guess it was that Monday when you had to hand in your study cards. Everything after that is bonded. By the way, you're listening to a piece of John Cage by the name of Inlets, which I'll talk about later. It's for three performers. It was done for a ballet. Three performers are all sitting on the stage, and each of them has three conch shells, one very, very large one, one medium one, and one small one. And they're in this big sort of like kitty litter dish with sand so you don't get too wet. And you pick up the conch shell. There's a microphone right above you, and when you tilt it, sometimes it gurgles. Sometimes it doesn't gurgle. You don't know what's going to happen when you do it. I was performing this piece with Cage, and at the rehearsal, he looked over and he said, I call this music of contingency because you don't know when you do it something what's going to happen. You don't know whether a sound's going to be made or a sound isn't going to be made. He said, but the one thing you really know for sure is if you don't do anything, nothing will happen. And this goes on for about 8 minutes, and in a few minutes, pretty soon, there'll be the sound of burning pine cones in the background. But I don't think I'll play that part. From 1977. Let's go back again into the... let's just talk for a couple minutes about the next couple weeks so you don't get confused, and then talk a little bit about the listening, and then we'll go on to what I wanted to talk about. Next Monday's class, there's class on Wednesday, as normal. Next Monday's class will be a review for the midterm. I won't be here, but the exam will be in four parts. And each one of the teaching fellows will give you a sample of what one of the parts is going to be like and how to think about it and how you could go about answering it. And they'll each take about 10 minutes to do that, leaving a little bit of time at the end for general questions, if you have any. Then a week from Wednesday is the midterm. Then November 4th in your syllabus, it says review of the midterm, but we're not going to do that because that was the day Milton Babbitt could come. And then I get back on that Wednesday of that week, and we'll have a class on both Wednesday and Friday of that week as well to make up for some of the time I was away. So that's what that's about. Now, cassette guide. The person I didn't mention on last week's tape, because I didn't get to her, is Ruth Crawford Seeger. Ruth Crawford Seeger was born in 1901 and died in 1950-something, or other, 53. She grew up as the daughter of a Protestant Methodist minister, actually, in Florida, and later moved to New York and then to Chicago. She composed music only the first half of her life. After that, because of social pressures and because it was very difficult for women to be composers in this country, she became quite a famous collector of folk music and folk songs and devoted the rest of her life to doing that. When she was young, she got into a very mystical kind of stance of a quasi-religion that was very popular both in Europe and this country called theosophy. I don't know if you've heard of it. It was sort of a mixture of Eastern thinking and American transcendentalism and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Started by this wonderful, crazy Russian lady, Madame Blavatsky, who ended up in New York and started the religion. She came to New York after having a circus act in Egypt riding horses. And she formalized this religion, wrote a lot of books on it, and the religion centered in New York and Chicago and Los Angeles for the most part. And Ruth Seeger first learned about it in New York and then got very into it in Chicago. It's funny how timing is, because last class I didn't get to it. Right after the class, I went to this meeting. And at this meeting, there's a woman who's writing a book on Ruth Crawford Seeger, and she gave me a new article she had just written about her. And I had never realized that Ruth Crawford Seeger was extremely influenced by Dame Rudyard. In her diary from November 9th, 1928, she writes, Rudyard reads some very beautiful poems. I begin to feel his beauty as never before. Previously, when he was here, I admired and stood afar, worshiping vaguely, you might say intellectually, because I was dazzled by his erudition. Now I begin to feel his greatness. Some part of the film has been lifted from my eyes. There is a rift in the clouds which were so dense before. I was impressed by Rudyard's vision of brotherhood of man, which blends all of human beings despite slight exteriors which are discordant. To bring together in harmony far-related objects is a glorious achievement. And so we see that dissonance is all a matter of point of view. It depends on us, whether we look at it from a tribal or universal approach. And although her music, when you listen to her string quartet, isn't overtly mystical on the surface, she had the same kind of beliefs that there was a kind of magic power in music that could transcend the logical and lead you to a mystical state. Now, if you turn to the last page of the cassette listening guide, this one's out of order because it was added to last year's class. It's number 3326.1016. It's very official. The first piece is probably the most traditional piece you'll listen to all semester, and it's a very ironic piece. It's a very Americana piece, Copland's tribute to Abraham Lincoln. At the period when he was writing this piece, he was before the House on Un-American Affairs, or what was that called, you know, the McCarthy hearings about being a communist. And they tried to censor this piece and not let it be played because they thought that Copland was a communist. And you're going to be reading an interview with Copland all about what those trials were like. And then I think when you listen to this piece, it won't make any sense at all why they, I mean, it's completely out of hand. This class, The Politics of New Music, which I didn't give because of the presidential inauguration, I will incorporate into other classes. Part of the reason for the class was a request from students last year to hear especially more music by women composers and black composers. And as I say, I will incorporate more of that as we go. But the ones you'll be listening to, let me just tell you a little bit about them. The first one is Lois Virk, Redshifts. Lois is about 35-year-old and lives in New York and was very influenced by Japanese music and has lived in Japan off and on quite a long period, close to 8 years off and on, and studied it extensively. The women composers I chose, I did not choose to be representative. I chose women composers that I think have extremely strong personalities and a great deal to say in their music. But I'm not trying to say that these four women or five women represent what women's music is about. I'm just giving you strong personalities. Eleanor Hovda is in her mid-50s. She lives in Minnesota. Her music, as you'll find, is very, very different than most of the you're listening to. And when she went to college, she went to about four different schools. None of her composition teachers would take her seriously. This is for two reasons. One, the music was strange, and also, especially about 30 years ago, there was a great deal of prejudice against women composers in this country. And a lot of the male teachers, especially of the older generation, sort of had this implicit idea that women could never be good composers. So consequently, she became very discouraged and dropped out of studying music and became a dancer, although she continued to write music her whole life. She just felt it was impossible to get any kind of formal training at that stage. Now she's teaching at Princeton as a guest teacher. James Newton, a King's Way. James Newton is a black jazz flute player who's been Downbeat Magazine's number one jazz flute player in this country for about the last 9 years. And in the last few years, he's been writing music also for concert halls, for chamber music. This particular piece is based on Martin Luther King. It's in three movements. The first movement is sort of about King's decision to take on the whole civil rights movement. The next movement, which is very Ivesian, I think you'll find, is about King in the middle of the civil rights movement. And the last movement, which is this very sort of sad, delicate little song, is about King's final vision, I Have a Dream idea. So James is an interesting figure because he's not in any way, he's trying to write a very personal music that's about, that's not trying to exclude his feelings about being a black American or exclude his feelings about being a jazz musician, but still write music that fits in the concert hall. Then we added two more that never made it to this. The next piece is by Joan LaBarbera. I tried to give you quite a few different generations of people. Joan LaBarbera. And I better look how to spell this piece because it's Dutch. It's called Vlissingen Harbor. V-L-I-S-S-I-N-G-E-N Harbor, written in 1982. Joan is about 45 years old. Excuse me. And made her reputation basically as what is known as extended vocal technique. She's explored all sorts of things you can do with the voice the singers have never tried in the past very often. And in this, you'll often hear some very strange sounds happening, and it's with chamber ensemble and her singing. whenever you hear an inexplicable sound, she's doing that with her voice, even if you don't think she can. Very, very good at it. She fits into a style which we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks. Actually, Wednesday we're going to introduce it, called minimalism, which is has a lot of repetition, and you can sort of tap your foot to it all the way through. The last one is by Jin-Hee Kim. Jin-Hee is quite young. She's in her early 30s. She grew up in Korea, moved to this country. By the way, it's called Linking, L-I-N-K-I-N-G. And I'm not quite sure when it was written. I just had it on a tape. She came to this country when she was about 15 and was formally educated quite thoroughly in Western music, although she had training as well in Korean. She's also very well trained in traditional Korean music. This piece is for string quartet. The Chrono String Quartet is going to be playing it. And again, she's a person who's not trying in any way to filter out any part of herself. It'll sound very much a mixture of Oriental and Western, and kind of an inexplicable blend that I don't think you've probably heard much like before. That's Chrono String Quartet. This, Fleethinken Harbor, is from a Nonesuch album which I recorded with the California Ear Unit. So it's quite an exotic tape. You should enjoy it. Okay. In I get you right dates again. In 1770, the same year Beethoven was born, and Beethoven's right there in the center, so, was a famous German philosopher who was also born by the name of Georg Hegel. And Hegel formalized a way of thinking philosophically, which became one of the most important ways of thinking philosophically for quite a few generations after that. He formalized what he called the dialectic. And the dialectic, which I'll talk about in a second, is very much related to the kind of music that was being written at that time. The dialectic usually is explained in its most simplistic terms, I wonder if they've changed the terminology since I was in college, as thesis and antithesis. So you have something, and that something is opposed, seemingly, or a friction, because there's something opposite. So if I have this and I have that, there's some sort of friction between the two because of duality. And then the higher level is what they call synthesis, where you perceive that really there's no duality, but both are part of the same unity, ultimately. And this is going to be kind of the philosophy of the form of most of the music in those days. Now, the whole notion of a dialectic is based on duality. The etymology of dialectic means to choose between. So a dialectic implies that there's a choice. If there's a choice, then there's this kind of expectation that's built in as you perceive things, because you start choosing one or the other, and it leads to kinds of expectations of predictability or what's going to happen next. It's really a cause and effect philosophy. Something happens because of this duality or this friction needing to work itself out that leads you in a kind of kinetic way to the next part of perception. The most common form in those days looked like this. It's called a sonata allegro form, or sonata form. It was in three parts, and I showed you this before, but I'm going to show it to you in more detail. The first part was called the exposition. The exposition started, if it didn't have an introduction, sometimes it did, with what we call theme one, or a tune. Theme one, let's use Arabic numerals actually, theme one, this being a tonal piece, had a loyalty to a certain note. Let's call this note Roman numeral one, the king. Okay, this theme is usually repeated, made familiar. This note is stabilized a great deal, and you feel very comfortable with it. Then you have a transition. And this transition takes you to a new theme. Let me just call it theme two, a new tune. Now, this establishes the first part of the immediate apparent conflict. Because theme two, rather than being loyal to this note over here, is loyal to its own note. It has a different note it's loyal to. For the sake of musical terminology, we'll call it Roman numeral five. It doesn't matter what you want to call it. It's just another note that is different from this one. So now you have this apparent conflict, because you have this theme, which was loyal to this note, opposed by this theme, which is loyal to a different note. Yes. It's usually a fifth. Usually. And then you have some sort of closure or conclusion to the exposition. So there's the beginning of your thesis antithesis. Now, the approach of the synthesis happens in the next section, which is called a development. The development starts in this key, usually moves through all sorts of keys. And what it does is it juxtaposes and combines theme one and theme two on top of each other often, or abruptly after each other, or mixes them up in different ways. So you hear them sort of back to back or on top or different ways. So it explores putting them on top of each other. Then what happens is we get to the recapitulation. And the recapitulation is very much like the exposition, except one basic difference. First you have theme one in its key, which it's loyal to. And then what happens is there's a transition again, and you have theme two, but instead of this key changing now, this theme is now loyal to the same note as the first theme. So this seeming opposition between keys is now gone. And what you realize in the development, essentially, is that what you thought was opposition are really just two aspects of the same thing. So when you get to the recapitulation, the friction between theme one and two is seen as a higher meta level now, and as no more a friction, but just two aspects of the same thing. And then you have some sort of closure again. Now, I thought I had said this, but Tony said I hadn't, so I will now. When I was in college, in a composition class, it was almost like a daily prayer. We had this slogan, which we said all the time, you know, like Pledge of Allegiance or something. And that slogan we said all the time was, repetition ensures closure. Notice that there's a high degree of repetition at the end of this. The whole basic first part of the piece is repeated with this change of keys, and that's what gives you this huge amount of closure. Now, usually, there's small levels of repetition internally, which guide you along the way. So, for example, there's usually quite a bit of repetition at the end of this section, so that you know that the section is over. Now, the one thing I didn't mention, which I told you about earlier, though, is that in the development, right about here, there's something we usually call a retransition. And at the retransition, the listener becomes aware, if not overtly, at least subliminally, that they're heading back. They're going back to where they came from. The piece has reached its climax. And notice the climax is about two-thirds of the way through. And then the retransition starts guiding you downhill again, and you know the piece is somehow or other about to close. And remember, the retransition happens at the golden mean. And we talked about the golden mean before. Just to review its definition real quickly, if I have a time length or a visual length, like here's A and here's B, well, the golden mean is defined as B is to A as C is to B. And it comes to about two-thirds. Golden mean goes back to the Greeks. It's been around a really long time. So this is essentially the dialectic of musical form. I don't think there's, almost inevitably, there's a coincidence between the kind of philosophical thinking and the way it manifests itself in the arts. And the fact that Hegel was born the exact same year as Beethoven, I think, is rather revealing of the fact of how important this was at that time and how many people were basically reasoning with this. Now, this is based on prediction. Basically, you have duality, so you're always predicting. Now let's talk for a second about perception and perception and how you perceive these kinds of things. Perception itself is a kind of quasi-dialectic in a strange way. The mind is doing one of two things consciously and doing both things subconsciously all the time. One thing the mind is doing is that it's absorbing information. Whatever sound comes to you, it listens to. You have your, 20,000 little hairs in your inner ear, which is listening to that sound and absorbing it. But then on another level of perception, you are gathering your information together in order to make a prediction, what's going to happen next. Remember, I've talked about how the neurons sort of keep making conclusions and basing conclusions on how often they are reinforced. Now, Western music tends to really emphasize prediction, especially Western classical music from this period. This whole thing is based on prediction. It's interesting that the human species is the only species where the female has pain at childbirth, and it's because the human head has grown so much since the early Homo sapiens came along, and the part of the head that has grown so much is the frontal lobes, and the frontal lobes are the part of the brain that makes predictions, tries to guess what's going to happen next. Consequently, it's grown so much that it's become a little bit painful, and I think music is fighting against it in a certain way, and we'll get back to Cage in a second on how that works. When one is perceiving, I think it's sort of like waves and particles or yin and yang. One is either in the state of absorbing the information or else reflecting on it consciously. It's sort of like, have you seen those, I'm sure you've seen aspects of it, like those Escher drawings where you look at it, and if you look at it one way, it looks like a whole bunch of cups, and somehow or another you can change your mind and you realize they're all silhouettes of faces. But you can't see both the silhouettes of faces and the cups at the same time. You have to be in one channel or the other channel. So when listening to a piece of music, the mind sort of goes back and forth between drawing conclusions and absorbing information. And that will be depending upon how the piece tells you to do that, and if it allows you to do that, and if it encourages you to do that, and how your own mind works. Now, what happens in a peculiar way is this kind of an interesting reversal or dialectic in perception. If you listen to something that where very little happens, let's just say it's a pure drone, I'm just humming one note for 3 hours. Let's say you could listen to that like a really good Buddhist and you didn't like worry about your legs hurting or how bored you were, about what you're going to have for dinner, anything. You just were listening to the sound. When listening to the sound and absorbing it, it seems like it's going by very slow because it's 100% predictable. You know what's going to happen every second. So it goes by very slowly. But when you think back on it, there's nothing to differentiate the time. You don't have something doing something and something going here. There's no differentiation. It's like having been asleep without dreaming. So when you think back on it, it went by very quickly because there's nothing to remember. So your perception dialectic makes this kind of kineticism. Let's say you're listening to a piece with lots of information, like a really thick Bach fugue. When you listen to a really thick Bach fugue, it seems like it's going by very quickly because there is so much information coming at you. You're always hearing things. Things are always appearing. But when you think back on it, there is so much information which you can remember and how it developed that it seems like it was much longer very often than it really was. You might, for a while, it's a very interesting experience because music is strange that way. Sometimes when you listen to a piece, guess how long it was, and then compare that with your clock and see how close you were. In the listening lab, it's a little bit artificial because you have so many other references to time. But it's funny, when you do this in classes and play a piece for people and have them guess how long it is, music can really trick you. So that some things that went by like in 5 minutes, people would swear took 20 minutes. And other things that went by in 20 minutes, people would swear only took 5 minutes. And this is a very common kind of perceptual thing. Okay, so how does the mind perceive then in this structure? Well, I'm going to go back to a model I gave you before. It's actually one I stole from a German musicologist, theorist. The mind listens, first of all, on the foreground level. Now, let's compare this to this talk today. You're listening to the words I say, and you're putting them together. How I say these words, and which ones I choose, and which ideas I choose, are basically very personal. They're my words, well, they're not my words, but they're the ones I choose. Then the mind groups the words to the middle ground. The mind groups the words to the middle ground, and we have ideas. These ideas transcend my personality. I'm able to communicate these ideas to you because we interact in a lot of social ways that we can agree upon. We're all in the same room together. We all know the same words. We all know the same images I'm talking about. So these ideas come to you because of our social intersection. when the talk is over, at the end of it, you think back on it and you think, what was the essence of it? What was the whole motivation? What was the basic idea behind the whole thing? And that's the background level. And we perceive a lot of things, obviously, this way. Another real good analogy, I think, is there's this wonderful kind of fern I used to grow for a while that either it grows in both sexes, male and female. Now, each fern on a foreground level, like any person, has its own personality. Some were bigger, some were smaller, some had darker leaves, some had brighter leaves. The fern was interesting because it was born with a propensity to be either male or female, but it wasn't totally determined. It was determined by the environment, finally. What would happen is the plant released a great deal of a male hormone. And if this hormone kept excreting, it was self-annihilating, and the plant turned to female. If at a certain stage the hormone stopped for some reason, then the plant would stay male. Now, what would happen is in a garden that was highly cluttered with a lot of these plants, the propensity would be to turn male because reproduction wasn't an advantage at that stage. Because if you had a whole bunch of female plants and they reproduced, you wouldn't have any space. If the plant grew up in a very sparse environment, the propensity would be to be female because then it could reproduce. So on the foreground level, each had its own personality. On the middle ground level, the plant was determined by its society or its garden. And on the background level, it was always that kind of fern. Whether or not it became a specific male or female, it was always that type of fern. So this is how perception works in a lot of ways. We keep trying to kick things to higher and higher levels in order to see the essence or the meaning behind them. And what I call background is the cultural level. Now, what if, for example, I thwarted your expectations. You always think I'm going to talk. What if your expectations are thrown on the middle ground level, so you have to stop drawing the same conclusions? If I do the same thing again, you might predict I'll do it a third time, and it won't really surprise you, right? But if I could write a piece in a certain way that plays with expectations so that you think something's going to happen, and then all of a sudden it's broken, you can't draw background conclusions because you can't sum things up. And this is exactly what's going to happen with the music of John Cage and Feldman and some of the others that we've been talking about. Essentially, what they're going to do is confuse memory in such a way that you're forced to come back to the personal level. Now, I think culturally, cultures have a blend of how much they predict and how much they absorb things in the minute. I think we tend to think of Eastern culture in general as being more in the moment, things like meditation, yoga, those kinds of events, some of the music, like Japanese no drama, which moves very, very, very slowly, tends to blend prediction and being in the moment more towards being in the moment. And as I say, this kind of form tends to really emphasize much more prediction than being in the moment. Now, if we live in a pluralistic society, which we do, and if Cage is going to say we must be receptive to everything because we have a whole new kind of population, we want to be open-minded and accept every member of our population as valid, then prediction, in a way, is bad because prediction limits your openness to accepting things. The more you predict something should be like something, the less you actually perceive a kind of open-mindedness. A good example of this is I lived in California for a long time in the high desert. And this time of year, when anyone from the East would come visit me, they'd always say, "This isn't at all like the East. There's no fall here. How can you live here? There's no autumn." Well, the only reason they thought there was no autumn was because that they predicted that autumn should look the same way it does here. And in the high desert, the autumn is very strong. It's just completely different. Plants that are white turn to deep red. Grasses turn to a golden color. There's all sorts of change. But if you predict that it should look like this, you cannot perceive it. So Cage is saying, let's get rid of the prediction. So, as you know, in music of changes, because he does everything by chance, you can't really predict what's going to happen. And in the piece I played for you before, there's no way of predicting what the next sound is going to be because even the person playing the sound doesn't know what's going to happen. So in about 1958, Cage decides, well, if I have this philosophy that every listener should be able to make their own relationships and hear a piece any way they want to, given the terms of the piece, why not experiment with liberating the performer? Why not, instead of telling the performer exactly what to play, giving him kind of a kit to make his own piece? And he wrote a piece called Fontana Mix. And Fontana Mix comes as a really nice kit. I would have brought it, but it's too small for you to see. It comes with a whole bunch of pages, about eight or so, that have six different kinds of squiggly lines on it. There are thick squiggly lines, there are medium squiggly lines, and there are very thin squiggly lines. It's hard to do with chalk. Then there are very thick, broken squiggly lines, medium broken squiggly lines, and little thin squiggly lines. And this is regular paper it's on with ink. Now the rest of the kit is all on transparent paper, like a film, you know, clear film acetate. And the next thing you get are a whole bunch of pages that are clear, but they have like about 15 different dots on them. And you lie one of the pages with dots over one of the pages with squiggly lines. So you get dots over the squiggly lines. Then you get a transparent graph, which is 20 units high, about 16-inch graph paper, and about 100 units long. And then you superimpose that graph any way you want over a portion of the page. This actually is looking pretty much like Fontana Mix, except I'm not drawing the graph. Then you get a piece of paper with just a line on it. It's transparent again. And you connect one dot on the graph to any one dot off the graph. And the intersection of this line determines the activities, although he doesn't tell you at all what those activities are. He tells you that this should be time somehow, moving across this way. So you might determine that your events are, this would be where your events happen in this time unit. You might decide that each one of these boxes lasts 10 seconds. And then you might decide that I have six different things I can make sounds with, for example. And every time one of those intersects the graph, I'll make a sound with that. And I might decide that the higher it is, for example, the louder it will be. But he doesn't tell you what to do with it. He just gives you this kit, and he says, make your piece with it any way you want to. The first piece he did with it was called Water Walk, which was for Italian TV. He was in 1958, he was in Milan, Italy, working on a tape piece. Actually, he was making a tape piece, an electronic piece, using Fontana Mix, too. And there was a quiz show on TV. I don't know if any of you remember the $64,000 question in this country. You'd go on 1 week, and you'd win like $1,000. And if you won, you'd go back the next week, and you'd win two. And then you'd go back. Each week would get harder. And eventually, you'd win twice as much, and twice as much, and twice as much. Well, there was a show like this on Italian TV, so Cage needed money desperately, and he entered it. It was, I forgot the Italian name. And his category was mushrooms. He's one of the foremost experts in mushrooms anywhere in the world. He loves mushrooms, goes hunting mushrooms all the time. He started the New York Mycological Society years ago and donated, I think, what was considered the largest amateur library about mushrooms in the United States to University of California, Santa Cruz. He went on, and they said, what do you do? And he said, I'm a composer. And they said, well, play something for us. And so he played a prepared piano piece the first week. And he won. So they invited him back. And they said, well, would you do another piece for us next week? And he said, well, I'd like to write one specifically for you. So he was very excited by the fact that Italian TV had lots of props. So he went through the prop department, and he got all the props that had anything to do with water. He got a bathtub, a pressure cooker, a siphon, a blender, roses, watering cans, and a wind-up rubber fish. Then he took Fontana Mix, and he associated each of these objects with one of these squiggly lines or whatever, and he made himself a 3-minute piece of activities he had to do using these objects on the stage. So he was madly running across the stage doing things. The piece started with him running over to the piano, winding up the fish, and you saw the tail hitting the strings. And then the piece ended with him at the bathtub, and the fish was swimming in the bathtub around a big vase with roses in it, and Cage was watering the roses while the pressure cooker was going off. Cage became a huge celebrity. He couldn't walk down the street without everyone wanting his autograph. He was on TV constantly. He even disguised himself so he wouldn't be bothered when he went out. He was voted the most simpatico contestant ever on Italian TV. So to finish the story quickly, he gets to the sixth week. And on the sixth week, they put him in an isolation booth. They hadn't done that before. And they asked him to name all the genera of white spore mushrooms. And Cage, of course, knew them and was meticulous and started saying each of them. And then they were translated into Italian. Then he did it all alphabetically so he wouldn't forget one. He didn't know there was a time limit because there wasn't before. And he was in this booth. And all of a sudden, he noticed the audience were all just like screaming and jumping up and trying to point to a clock behind him. But he didn't even know there was a clock behind him. And in the typical Cagean way, he won 1/2 second before the time limit was over, just calmly listing each of them. And he took the money, returned to America, and sponsored the first tour with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company with that particular money. By the way, the filmmaker Fellini, Federico Fellini, was starting to work on a film called La Dolce Vita, which is quite famous, and he asked Cage if he would star in it. But Cage didn't feel like staying in Italy anymore, and he was so tired of people asking for autographs and being so famous that he was also getting quite sick from, physically, he got bronchitis. So, consequently, Cage, with pieces like Fontana Mix, is disassociating himself now from the performer in a certain kind of way, much more extremely than a piece like Music of Changes, which is all notated. And in Inlets, he's even taken it one step further. That's the piece at the beginning, because now he's even disassociating the performer from his instrument. The performer doesn't know what's going to happen with the instrument from one moment to the next. Let's conclude today with a piece called Theater Piece. If you just take about 2 minutes and write down and number them 20 nouns and verbs. Just write down 20 nouns. Anyone, they can be concrete, they can be names, they can be places, they can be abstract nouns, they can be abstract verbs, anything you want. Pardon? No, just 20 all total. And they don't have to be, you could just do nouns if you'd rather. Normally you put these on cards because you replace them sometimes, but we won't play it that way. We should have like the theme music from Jeopardy or something. If you want to sing it, Tony. This was a piece he wrote in 1958, also called Theater Piece. It looks like this. This is just, there's a whole bunch of pages that look, that have numbers like that and lines. Big numbers and then four groups of small numbers under each of them. Are you done? Okay, this is a way Cage thought of how you could make an abstract theater piece. Again, allowing the performer to draw their own conclusions about what actions they should make, but by giving them this kind of context of how to think about them. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to use these words to somehow inspire some sort of activity. He says the piece is about music, but anyone can be anything they want to be. So if they're a dancer, they can be a dancer. If they're a plumber, they can be a plumber. He said, but since it's a musical piece, you should always think about whether or not you want to draw a conclusion of what to do in sound. So what does this tell you? First of all, the first action I'm going to do is number 6. So you look on your chart, and that's going to be the essence of your action, number 6. Okay. Then I'm allowed, let's say I just did this morning with random words. I just took a book and opened it randomly and took the first 20 nouns and verbs. For this one, I got the word formulate. Okay, now you're allowed to ask 4 specific questions if you would like, you don't have to, about how to perform this action. And you can ask any questions you want to, and here are your answers. Okay? So if it's an X, you can answer the question any way you want. This morning I got, again, this was done completely randomly, I asked the questions before I had the words. I asked here, in what manner? And so I got X, so I don't know what manner that is. For this one, I asked with what attitude, and I got the word physics. So I'm going to formulate in, with the attitude of physics. Here for 15, 16, and 17, I asked the question with what material? That was interesting because I got glass, concepts, and density. And here I asked how loud? So I got the word weight. So for example, there's a lot of ways I could answer this, and probably everyone in the room would answer it slightly differently. I could, for example, blow on glass wind chimes, the physics of glass wind chimes, and get a glass sound. That would be a very simple solution to it. I could make it obviously much more complex. With the weight, or I could, for example, drop the glass wind chimes and drop a weight onto it, for example, to make the sound I wanted to. Everyone makes their own score, and the only reason to rehearse the score, because everyone performs it simultaneously, is so that no one hurts anyone else on the stage because one of their actions. So now, how do I know what to do? You take a ruler, and you decide with your ruler, see this line under this, 6? You measure that, and you decide how to translate that into time. So let's decide 1 inch is 1 minute. So let's say this one comes out to something like 1.5 minutes. Simultaneously, after about 1 minute, I would start this action, which is about number 9. Okay? And then I would measure this, and let's say this one comes out to 45 seconds, because it's a little slower, a little shorter. And then this one ends partway through, and then this one begins, and this one's very short. This would only be about 1 second. Let's say 3 seconds. And I would perform that particular action. It's a little bit more complicated than this, but there's no reason for you to get into those kind of rules. The piece lasts exactly 30 minutes, and it's usually done with 8 players. And so each player either has a stopwatch or you put a central clock that everyone can watch, because they have to, and you have to carry a score with you if you're moving, because all of these have to be absolutely precise in their timing. Now, this action doesn't have to last 1.5 minutes, but it has to take place in this time frame. It can last up to 1.5 minutes. It could start anywhere in the time frame. It could be a very brief action. If I'm just dropping the weight on glass wind chimes, that would only take a second. But I could do it any time during this 1.5 minutes. So I would like you, just for the sake of experiencing this a little bit, for next class, to realize this with your words for me and to write an explanation of what you would do. And on that, I'd like you to hand it in next time. Would you put your name and your section leader? Conceivably, we might even try performing this in the sections and bringing it to class at some stage. We'll see how much time we have. But what's interesting about it now is it's a new kind of theater of simultaneity, because each of these actors... abstract words, and you're going to have to make a judgment. That judgment could be very extreme. I saw a performance of it once where the first action, the guy decided would last 30 minutes. And he had someone come on stage, and for some reason he decided, and he's very true to Cage, he absolutely loves him, that what his action meant was to have his assistant tie him up and he would sit there for 30 minutes. you could choose not to perform based on your numbers, depending on what your action was. But what you start happening now is, on the surface or on the foreground, you get a lot of personality, and usually watching theater pieces is a lot of fun, because usually the actions end up being quite absurd. Now, on the middle ground level, you're going to start seeing lots of relationships between the different performers. Like if someone is doing something and someone else is doing something else, your mind's going to relate them and see them kind of as some component of a larger activity, because your mind can't help that. But when you try to get to the background level with this idea, whenever you try to make it add up to mean something, it never can, you see? It's like when I stopped talking before. Always your expectations are thwarted at the middle ground level. So the mind is left back on the surface and not in the background. And this is what I was talking about in Feldman also when I talked about a flat surface without perspective. Perspective is a background idea. If you can eliminate through the simultaneity of many different actions at the same time that never add up, you've eliminated perspective, you've eliminated background, and you start switching music into the present. And maybe, if American culture is different, maybe art is a way of helping recondition the mind to think differently. Maybe by doing things like this and experiencing pieces like this, you're putting a little more emphasis on the moment and less in prediction. And maybe this becomes almost a social gesture to help the mind retrain for a new future. So anyway, if you'd bring these next week, and you don't have to write extensively and they don't have to be neat, I would just like to see the kinds of things you come up with. See you on Wednesday.